Well, it's so nice to see everybody out here. I have to say you're a very supportive group. It kind of makes it easier to sit up here when I see friendly faces and everything. It's just easier. So thank you all very much for your attention. And I think as you all are aware, we've just finished a month working with the Parami of Renunciation and are getting ready for a month with the Parami of Wisdom. So I'm hoping this talk tonight will be sort of a transition between the two, a little bit about renunciation and a little bit about wisdom as well. And over the past month, that Tim really beautifully pointed out the close relationship between renunciation and wisdom, and how ideally we practice renunciation, you know, not as a kind of a punishment or a penance or something like that, but something that we do out of wisdom, because we can really see that letting go of whatever it is we let go of is the best thing for us. It's healthier for us. It will make us happier, will lead to less suffering for ourselves and for those around us. And Ajahn Suchito, in his book on the Paramis, which is a really wonderful book, and I really recommend it as reading over this year, he talks about it in very much the same way, and talks about renunciation as being a practice of wise discernment. So we can consider all of the different things out there that we might want to do or to have or to say or to think, and from those actually choose the ones that are helpful and that are necessary and go on from there. So renunciation is practiced out of wisdom, but at the same time, you know, it goes the other way too. By practicing renunciation, we can really develop and deepen our wisdom. And so that's the aspect I'd like to stress this evening, how by practicing renunciation, we can really learn a lot. And I think that's something that all of you probably would agree with over the past weeks. Now, as Tim has noticed, talked about, renunciation is a parami that we really practice every day, even if we don't necessarily think about it as renunciation. I mean, every time we sit down on our meditation cushion and our mind starts to go off to that pleasant daydream, and we bring it back to our body, our breath, what's happening in the present moment, we're practicing renunciation. When we get up early in the morning to sit instead of sleeping in a little bit later. When we feel like we'd like to snap at our spouse or our partner because they forgot to take out the garbage or they left their dirty socks on the floor, and we pause, take a breath, and just don't say it, we're practicing renunciation. So anytime we back off from a habit pattern, an impulse, something that we're used to doing in order to do something that's wiser, more worthwhile, we're practicing renunciation. And as Tim pointed out last week, the ultimate renunciation is renouncing the whole cycle of clinging and craving itself. The renunciation that really leads to complete peace, to nibbana. So renunciation is this very special process that's really at the heart of our practice, it's letting go. But at the same time, it's a parami that we can practice in a very deliberate and intent way, in an intentional way for a fixed period of time. And we can learn from it that way as well. And we might want to do this for a variety of different reasons. We do it when we go on retreat, so that we can make time in our lives for something that's really important. You know, when we go on retreat, we observe the noble silence, we give up talking, we give up reading and writing, we give up our typical entertainments. Maybe we even give up eating any kind of solid food after the noon meal. And we do all of these things, you know, not because there's anything bad or wrong about talking or reading or writing or eating dinner, but so that we can really focus our attention fully on our meditation practice and what's going on in our body and mind, and really look deeply at that experience. And sometimes in daily life, we might do something kind of similar. For example, say we maybe have a practice of going out to eat once a week. Maybe for a while we might decide that we won't do that and save the money so we can give it to some sort of charity or special cause that we really think is important, and we can get some happiness out of that. So, you know, renunciation doesn't necessarily have to be giving up something that we feel is kind of bad or we shouldn't be doing. It could be something that's perfectly fine, but we refrain from it for a while because we want to do something else that's, you know, kind of special, maybe more important or better for that period of time. We might also practice renunciation just to simplify our lives. I mean, we're so caught up often in the cultural messages that we have to do more, we have to have more, we have to be more. And so sometimes it's nice to just sort of step back and say, in her book on the paramis, Sylvia Boorstein talks about this, you know, how we're inundated all the time with all of these messages about how, oh, you should do this, you should buy that, so on. It's kind of nice to be able to hear that and just say, well, no, thank you. I have everything I need right here. And so practicing renunciation in that way can help us really develop a sense of contentment, because we realize that we do have what we need. We can also practice renunciation to loosen the grip of habits that don't really serve us that well. And I think that's often what we think about when we think about renunciation. You know, giving up that unhealthy habit that isn't all that great for my mind, isn't all that great for my body, wastes a lot of time I might be spending doing something more useful. And ideally, we do this not out of a sense of how bad we are and how out of control we are for doing these things, but out of wisdom and compassion for ourselves, doing something that we realize is really good for us in the long run. But finally, I think maybe the most important reason of all for practicing renunciation, and I think we're doing this even if our initial motives are some of these other things, is to practice renunciation so we can really understand more about craving and desire. So we can practice it as a way of really getting to know more about the second noble truth. Now, the first noble truth, of course, as many of us know, is the truth of dukkha, or the truth of suffering, dissatisfaction, discontent. The truth that we're really not very happy for very long with the conditions of our human life. And well, this noble truth, this first noble truth, really accepting it very, very deeply, understanding it fully, is a lifetime process. At the same time, you know, on the surface of it, on a more superficial level, it's not so difficult to appreciate or understand. I think that most of us, most people anywhere, would agree that life includes painful experiences, instability, change, things don't always turn out the way that we want them to turn out, and we don't always get the things that we want, and when that happens, it makes us unhappy. I mean, that's kind of like, well, yeah, that's not hard to understand. But then the second noble truth comes along and says that the reason that we're unhappy isn't because we're not getting all these things that we want, it's because of craving. So it's not because we haven't been smart enough or lucky enough or born in the right circumstances or whatever, you know, to be able to get the things that we want. It's because of the wanting itself. And when you think about that, it's like, huh? You know, I think this is a lot harder to really wrap our heads around. I think our initial reaction is often resistance. You know, we're this idea that, you know, the problem is the wanting itself. It's like, wait a minute. What do you mean? You're saying I'm not supposed to want anything? How could that even be? How could I not want anything? And we think, you know, if I don't want anything, well, what's happening to, you know, our ambitions, our dreams, our... Where would we have any motivation to do anything? It just seems too impossible. And, you know, after all, a lot of the things we want are good things. What about that? You know, it's like when we hear the second noble truth, we may have a lot of doubts. We may have a lot of objections. But when we intentionally practice renunciation and we give up something that we like or enjoy or want or in the, and you know, generally are kind of in the habit of getting for a period of time, then we really have a chance to investigate more fully what this whole thing of craving and wanting is. And to test out the second noble truth for ourselves. You know, what is this experience of wanting or craving that we're putting us ourselves in a position where we're going to have to feel it? What is it really like? Is it really true that it's this wanting that makes us unhappy rather than not getting the object? So there's a lot to learn if we're willing to take the time to practice renunciation. We learn about our relationship with pleasant things in our lives. We learn about the power of habit, about the nature of desire itself, and about the second noble truth. So tonight I'd like to talk about some of the things that I've learned, and I suspect that many of you have learned over the past few weeks by doing this practice, as many of us have, of, you know, refraining from giving up some kind of, some little thing that we're used to having, that we like to have, just to see, what does that feel like? How do we approach it? And when we reflect on these different things that we've learned, well, I don't know about you. I'm not sure I would be able to say that my heart now leaps at the idea of renunciation. But I think certainly, I have a lot more appreciation for the value of the practice, and I expect that many of you do too. So what do we learn when we undertake this practice? Well, I think one of the first things we learn is how difficult it is and how much resistance we have toward it. And I first got interested in this parami by noticing this very thing through an experience that I had with a KM book group that I belong to. And within our book group, we just finished reading this really, really tedious, very scholarly book that had all of the stuff in it about refined mind states and Buddhist psychology in a way that was pretty dry and pretty difficult, and we were like, oh no, no, enough, enough. We don't want any more of this. We need something else. So we decided we would do this very light-feeling book called Making a Change for Good. So we got the book, and one of the first exercises in the book was to choose some behavior that you weren't very happy with, and just notice all of the things about it. You know, what you tell yourself about the behavior, what triggers it, how you feel when you're doing it, so on and so forth. You know, in other words, you know, be mindful while you're doing this behavior. And that sounds pretty straightforward, right? I mean, you'd think this group of people that were, you know, had been practicing the Dhamma for a while, it's like, oh yeah, right, we can, no big deal. But after we, you know, went off to do this exercise, we met in a couple weeks and we found nobody had done the exercise. Nobody. And there were the usual excuses, you know, oh, I meant to do it, but I got so busy with work, and I just forgot, and so on and so forth. And then after that, then there started the complaints about the exercise itself, that, well, you know, it was just kind of too psychological, and it wasn't really serious Dharma, and it was kind of trivial, and the things we were supposed to learn, we already know that we're not supposed to criticize ourselves, and, you know, and these kind of behaviors that they were giving examples of, like eating sweets and not going to the gym. I mean, these were just such, you know, culture-bound things. And then finally somebody decided they better get real about this, and they said, well, it wasn't me, it was somebody else. They said, you know, the truth is, I just didn't want to do it because I didn't want to experience the uncomfortable feelings I'd have if I spent the week really looking at this habit. And that's what it is. I mean, we don't want to practice renunciation because it's uncomfortable. And so when we intentionally put ourselves into a position where we're going to try to do this, or, you know, even contemplate doing it, let alone actually carrying it out, we may come to face to face with some pretty unpleasant emotions. There might be a lot of fear as we start to contemplate this, you know, about giving up our routines that give us pleasure and comfort. You know, it's not comfortable to change. We might be afraid of the thoughts and emotions that might come up, that if we don't have our distractions to take our attention away from them. And we might have ideas about renunciation that make it seem unattractive, like Tim was talking about over the past weeks. We might think it's very rigid, very puritanical, maybe seems like a really phony and goody-goody thing to do, or maybe when we try to do something like this, it brings up a lot of feelings of self-criticism and self-hatred because we feel like we can't do the things that we should do. So those are very uncomfortable. We begin to, you know, feel like we're a defective person that needs to be fixed, and maybe we can't fix ourselves. And then, of course, simply not having what you want is not a pleasant feeling. Going against the routine is not a pleasant feeling. I mean, when we totally know this, when we have a big disappointment in our lives, you know, if we, you know, something goes wrong in our career, we have a setback, you know, the love affair that doesn't turn out the way we wanted it to, losing something important to us, that's really, really hard. And it takes a long time to, you know, be able to get through something like that. And even when it's something really small and trivial, you know, like having a cup of coffee or a piece of cake, I mean, not getting it and wanting it isn't very pleasant. So, you know, let's face it, it's this process of renunciation is hard. I mean, we know that it's hard if, as Tim said in his story, that even the Buddha himself, when he was a bodhisattva, felt like I know this is a really good thing, but I just can't feel that excited about it. So if he was like that, you know, imagine for us. It's not an easy thing to do. So one of the first things I think when we decide we're going to do it, maybe are the reasons why we really shouldn't. First, there's this idea that maybe there isn't really a need. The habits we have are, you know, they're no problem. You know, there's not any real reason to refrain from these things. They aren't really that harmful, which may be true, really. Although, of course, we have to be honest with ourselves about this, because sometimes we just don't want to see the way that these habits get in the way of things we might be doing that might be a lot more helpful for us. And then, you know, there's always this idea of, well, you know, this is kind of a trivial thing to do, and I'm not really going to learn that much about it. Well, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I think it's important when these kind of thoughts come up to remember that why we're doing this, and remember, you know, it's not really about whether I eat the Cheetos or don't eat the Cheetos. You know, it's really about understanding how we relate to pleasant experience, forces of craving, the forces of habit, and the possibility of being free from them. So it's really a pretty big thing that goes beyond, you know, whether we, you know, eat our junk food or play on our computers or those kind of things for a while. And then even once we recognize this is a good thing and we decide, okay, we're going to do this, we may notice all kinds of excuses coming up for delaying. And this is one of the things I really noticed myself. One of the first things that I started to think about, you know, after Tim gave his first talk, and I was thinking, well, okay, I'll give up something, was, what could I do? What should I give up? And all this laundry list of possibilities comes out. Well, maybe TV would be good. You know, it would be nice. I could get a lot more done if I, you know, didn't waste time watching TV. Or, well, sweets, of course, you can always do that. Now, maybe meat. I don't eat very much meat, but every now and then, you know, I have my chicken, I have my fish, I could give up that. Maybe I could just really, you know, take this thing seriously and try to practice the 8 precepts through this whole time. Well, that idea lasted about, you know, a minute, but, you know, it's like, so there's all of these things, and pretty soon I realized I could spend a month just trying to figure out what I was going to give up and never do anything, you know. And then so I was finally, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to worry about this. I'll just give up sweets. Then, of course, there was this idea of, well, but wait a minute. Am I going to do this all the time? Is it like, I'm not going to eat, you know, ice cream cake, but can I have jam on my toast for breakfast? Is that okay? And what about my niece's birthday? Can I have some cake? When I go to the ballet and we get our free chocolates for, you know, at the donor's lounge that I get for giving them money, surely I can't give up my perks. I spent good money to get these perks, you know. So it's like, but then that too, pretty soon, you know, this exception, that exception, this exception, you waste a lot of time thinking about the exceptions. Well, and then there's always like, well, but I could start today, but maybe I should start in a couple of days after I eat those pinwheel cookies that are in the cupboard, you know. So more excuses. And you just have to kind of say, okay, let's make up your mind. Just do this thing. Maybe you have your one exception for the chocolates at the donor's lounge at the ballet, but that's it. So finally, we're like, okay, excuses out of the way, move on to the next phase. And so we're actually doing this. And as we're doing this, I think we may observe many more things about our attitudes and how our minds work. One thing we may notice is our identification with our habits and our actions. This practice of renunciation might get entangled with our ideas of ourselves as bad people or sinful people who need fixing by not doing these things that we shouldn't be doing, or maybe with some idea we have of ourselves as a spiritual person that doesn't indulge in these worldly pleasures. And I think a lot of times, you know, we don't really consciously think these things, you know, we're not really out there thinking, oh, I'm such a bad person, or oh, I'm so spiritual, I'm doing all that, you know, we don't really think those things consciously, but it's sort of these attitudes kind of creep up from below, maybe from holdovers from other training we've had, you know, maybe if we're from a Christian tradition and we're used to, you know, giving up for Lent or things like that, or maybe even from Buddhism too, where we have this here about how craving leads to suffering, so we get some idea that it's good to avoid anything where we might feel too much liking of it, because then there might be craving and then there might be suffering. So if these things, doing these practices is a good opportunity for us to see these sort of attitudes maybe that are kind of buried and hidden and that we might not really notice otherwise. Doing this practice also can give us a lot of insight into what our relation is really like with this thing or activity that we're giving up. It might be something that we just really, really like a lot and we want to do. But on the other hand, it might be more the kind of thing that's, you know, pleasant enough, but what really is appealing about it is that it lets us to just kind of zone out into this sort of mindless place where we don't really have to think about anything. I mean, there's a lot of activities like that. Or mainly, its function really is as something to do whenever something uncomfortable comes up, painful, unpleasant. It's a good distraction from those things. Or it's a good thing to do when you want to procrastinate. You really don't feel like doing some other thing that you know you really ought to be doing. So, oh my, this is a really good time to check my email, or, you know, play that little game on my phone, or this or that. You know, the habit could function in that way too. We might also notice when we actually are most likely to fall prey to these different habits. You know, it could be times that are stressful or painful, but it also might be when we're simply distracted. And I noticed this very clearly myself. There was one time about 2 or 3 days after I'd started my no sweets thing, when I had to go down to Olympia for a meeting for work, and we were supposed to stop for lunch on the way down, but one of the people was delayed, so we couldn't do that. So I wasn't quite sure. I had this orange, and I'm like, that's not going to be very fun to just have this orange. And then just as I was heading out the door, somebody walked in with this box of leftover donuts from this other meeting. So I'm like, donut, donut. I didn't even think about it. I grabbed a donut, I stuck it in my pack, headed out, got in the car. You know, we were heading down the freeway. I took it out, grabbed it, put it in my mouth. I'm halfway through this donut, and then all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be refraining from sweets. Whoops. So, you know, I just wasn't thinking. And then, of course, you know, there's peer pressure and proximity of the thing. You know, at work it seems like somebody's always bringing in some sort of leftover something. Naturally, we all bring them because we have them at home and we don't want to eat them at home, so we're like, you know. But, you know, everybody else would be enjoying this thing, so that would be one of the times when I would be most tempted, you know. Here it is, everybody else is doing it. So maybe others of you have noticed that too, you know, those kind of triggers, plus, you know, stress, tension, I've had a hard day, I deserve a reward, all of these kind of things. So you sort of, you know, you get a good idea of when you indulge and why you indulge. You also may be able to actually see this activity or thing as it really is more clearly by doing this process. I mean, most generally, as we go along in our, you know, several weeks of renunciation, we'll get to the point where we go ahead and do the thing that we intended not to do anyway. It might be one of those planned exceptions where we're like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do it at this time, you know, but I'm not going to do it other times. So you end up actually doing this thing or having this thing or whatever. And if you're actually able to be mindful while you're doing the activity, which actually is really, really hard, as I'm sure that many of you recognize quite clearly. I mean, part of the whole thing of these activities are that we do them when we're not being mindful, and maybe when we don't want to be mindful. But if we're able to be mindful, we may learn something about what this activity actually feels like. Is it really as pleasant as we kind of tend to think it is? You know, maybe the thing itself isn't so pleasant, it's all these associations and ideas that go along with it, where the thing itself is sort of, you know, not quite the daydream of it. Or, and I think this is true for many of the things that we enjoy, it might be, you know, really quite pleasant, but only just for so long. You know, certainly chocolate is very pleasant, you know, but if you eat a whole box of them, not very pleasant, not very pleasant. Or also, you know, there is this sense in that it's very pleasant, but the pleasure is very, very fleeting, you know, you enjoy it and then it's gone. What was that? You know, it's like nothing. And then you may notice too about how you feel after you've done the thing. Maybe you feel, you know, happy and satisfied, like perhaps you said, okay, I'm going to enjoy this thing this one time and I made up my mind to do it. I already know I'm going to do it. I enjoyed it, it was pleasant, now I'm going to go on, not a problem, that's great. Or maybe you feel not that way though. You might feel kind of drained, you might feel kind of dull, maybe you feel sort of guilty that you went ahead and did the thing. And maybe you feel like, well, was that really worth it? Did I really get that much pleasure out of it? One of the things that's kind of interesting, too, is when we really notice these behaviors of ours very clearly, sometimes the thrill of doing it sort of goes away. We find that, you know, we don't really want to do it that much or care that much if we do it. If we're doing the behavior or habit to avoid painful or unpleasant emotions, when we abandon that habit, then these things may very well come forth. And maybe they are really, really hard to cope with. But it also might be that we find that what we were so afraid of feeling is actually not that bad at all and quite bearable and quite, you know, we're quite able to handle it and not something that we really need to dread or try to escape from. And then finally, I think one of the most important things is that when we do this practice of renunciation, we come face to face with what wanting actually feels like. And a lot of times we really don't notice what wanting really feels like. I mean, I know that I was told this, I was going through a period where I was wanting a certain thing and not able to get it and very upset with it. And my teachers told me, well, you know, turn your attention to the wanting. Turn your attention to the wanting. And it just was really hard to actually do that and understand what they meant. But when we are able to do that, I think we're not able to do that often because we're so caught up in the fantasy about what we want and our dreams about how great it will be when we can get it or our schemes about how we're going to get it that we don't feel the wanting. We feel like the desire is pleasurable because we're in this fantasy of fulfillment. But if we step back from that and we kind of, if we're doing this renunciation where we say, okay, you know, I'm intentionally not going to fulfill this desire, we can't really go too far into the dream of fulfillment. We're kind of stuck with the wanting. And when we're stuck with the wanting, we realize it really is not a very pleasant feeling. You know, even there's a lot of restlessness, there's a lot of discontentedness. It really isn't a very pleasant feeling. But as we continue, you know, and our focus shifts from the object of wanting to the feeling of wanting ourselves, wanting itself, and to its unpleasantness, I think one of the things that we may realize, and which is actually rather shocking when you think about it, is that a lot of the time it's really the desire to get rid of this uncomfortable feeling of wanting that causes us to finally reach out and take the thing. It's like, ah, I got it. Finally, this horrid feeling of craving is gone. Well, for a little while. You know, it always comes back. For a little while. But as you begin to see this, you know, this sort of cycle where you have this object and you keep reaching for the object, not because of it, but so you won't have to feel this craving, but then you have the object, the craving starts again, and you reach for it again to get rid of the craving. I mean, you start to see how crazy this cycle is. I mean, you know, it's just sort of nuts when you keep feeding this thing, trying to get rid of it, but keep feeding it over and over again. It's just sort of crazy. And so I think as we see this more clearly, we begin to have this sense of not wanting the object so much as wanting to be free of this cycle of craving. And when we begin to have this sense of recognizing the value of being free from this craving, then we really start to understand the second noble truth, because we're sort of really seeing, you know, it's getting caught up in this craving that's making me miserable. The object, you know, it's fine, it's okay, but it's not that big of a deal. So this really is a good thing. It's a big shift of attitude that can bring us, you know, closer to having the kind of mindset that's really aspiring to liberation. So that's quite a really cool thing. And I think one of the things that can happen is when we start to see this, even though, you know, we maybe still are sort of uncomfortable and wanting and stuff, there can be this sort of delight from understanding it. You know, it's so even in the middle of discomfort, there can be a sort of feeling of delight in the mind from knowing something rather special. And also, you know, as we see this often enough, see it clearly enough, the unpleasantness of wanting, the futility and the nuttiness of being caught up in this cycle of craving, eventually we get to a point where the mind says, you know, this is nuts. Let's just stop. And there is, maybe for a particular behavior, for a particular attitude, there's this recognition, you know, this is just leading to suffering. We can stop. And I think, you know, Tim talked about this last week, of getting to this point. And it may take a long time, you know. It's not like we see something, boom, we never have a problem with it anymore. You know, it may take a long time, but gradually seeing these things, seeing it sort of loosens the hold over our mind that this kind of cycle of craving has on it, has on the mind. As we hang in there too, we also discover that even the most uncomfortable feelings do pass. You know, this uncomfortable desire doesn't last forever. The feeling of wanting does go away. And so that really helps, you know, that really helps. We can feel like the uncomfortable desires will pass. I have them, but I don't have to be trapped by them. And I think something else, too, that we see, just as we experience the uncomfortableness of wanting, we experience the relief of not wanting. When we get to that point where, you know, we can let go, or when we just simply notice, as we are going through our day-to-day life, when there isn't any wanting there, when we feel content, when we don't really need anything else, when we have a sense that we have enough. And I think, you know, if it's especially true if you are able to, you know, let go of some sort of really persistent habit or obsession or something that's been troubling you for a long time, and you finally get through it. I think maybe some of you have experienced this sense of relief of, finally, I'm not caught up in that anymore. And I think having some appreciation of that sense of relief, of how good it feels not to be caught up in wanting this or that or restlessly seeking this or that, really helps us to appreciate the value of equanimity, of contentment. And we can kind of understand, you know, that there is an end to craving and there is an end to suffering. So it sort of gives us some sense of the potential for the third noble truth, too. So it's just a very big kind of learning that we can have. And I think too, when some of this cycle of craving begins to loosen a little bit, and we can have more of a feeling of that, you know, we don't have to have, we may find we have a greater sense of gratitude and appreciation for the pleasant things that do come our way. There's this sense that it really doesn't make sense to get caught up in trying to hang on, to get caught up in trying to get more. So we're more willing to allow them to come and go, and when they're there, we can enjoy them and appreciate them more fully. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing, you know, that I remember noticing this one time when I was on retreat. I it was one of those times that sometimes comes, you know, when you're in an intensive retreat, when you have these really pleasant feelings in the body. It's like, everything is just, oh, so nice, so lovely. And so I started to have these feelings and, of course, enjoy it, of course, you know. And at first it was just like, oh, this is really nice, this is really pleasant, and so on and so forth. And then pretty soon there was this kind of feeling of tension. And, oh, how long is this going to last? What could I do to make it a little bit even more, you know, and all of this sort of thing. And luckily, because I was in that retreat environment and very sensitive, I could feel that tension and feel that tightness actually taking away the pleasure associated with just having this pleasant body experience. So it was more kind of a worry and tension than enjoying the pleasant. And I was like, ooh, wait a minute. This is crazy. And so was able to say, okay, you know, I can see that this, you know, just relax, set back, you know, let it come, let it go. If it goes, it goes, you know. And I think that's the way it is with many of these things, you know. If we get caught up in hanging on to what is pleasant and trying to keep it, get more of it, we can't even really enjoy it when we have it, which also is another kind of paradoxical and crazy thing about this cycle of wanting. So we may begin, as we sort begin to loosen this cycle, we may find that we have a lot more appreciation, we have a lot more gratitude, we have a lot more joy, a lot more freedom. We appreciate the beautiful things that come our way, but at the same time we recognize their temporary nature, and we can see more clearly when to enjoy, when not to enjoy, when to let them pass by. You know, there's just a lot more freedom. A lot more freedom. And then, of course, you know, with all of these big things that we do, you know, over this few weeks of practice of renunciation, we may also see that little practical thing, that whatever it was we were working with, its hold on us is not so great. It's not such a big thing anymore. We recognize that it's nice when we enjoy it, but we don't have to have it. We may go back into our, you know, regular behaviors with more wisdom, with more sense about what we do, when we do it. And I think also a feeling that many of our other habits and desires that may or may not be all that helpful are much more workable. You know, when we see this working with one thing, we realize that other things can be workable too, and that can be a very practical and helpful thing. So, in summary, renunciation isn't about penance or deprivation, or about becoming an ascetic, but first and foremost, it's a practice that provides us with the opportunity to investigate and understand craving and desire, and to really free ourselves from that cycle. So when we practice renunciation, you know, at the very bottom, what we're really doing is investigating the Four Noble Truths, and really seeing for ourselves that there's dukkha, that insatiable wanting leads to dukkha, and that there's an end to craving and an end to dukkha. And I'd like to end with a quotation from Ajahn Suchito, He says, the parami of renunciation gives you the focus to see craving for what it is. And if developed, the wisdom to not participate in the attempt to fill its bottomless hole. Renunciation also encourages you to develop other sources of fulfillment. But the most valuable thing that viewing craving from the vantage point of renunciation offers is the realization that just this abandoning of craving is what the Buddha meant by enlightenment. This is the essence of the Four Noble Truths, and this is what is meant by Nibbana. The complete ending of sorrow, lack, confusion, and despair. And to sense that is worth giving up a lot. Let's sit for a few minutes together. Even the gods envy the awakened ones, the mindful ones, the wise ones, who are intent on meditation and delight in the peace of renunciation. Thank you for listening to the Dhamma. And now there's some time if anybody has any comments or questions, or if maybe you would like to share some of the wisdom you have gathered over the last few weeks.
Thinking of something, Tweri was talking about brain research that was done, that the neurons connect in links, and so the habit is formed, and that they found that through meditation, that's a way to be able to break those links. And I was thinking of just habits that I find myself involved in, and how the hardest part is right. Like if I'm eating something, and I know there's another bite, but I can't find, you know, like I, it's not, like I'm just right at that point where I have to have that. Mm-hmm. Very hard not to have it there. But in other points in the link, I might be at a less challenging point, and I can say, why don't I wait and see if I really need this? And just that little bit of renunciation of the immediacy, I find is really helpful. And that I have learned that through meditating, because when you sit and you committed to sitting and you start to get uncomfortable, but you say, oh no, I can do it. And I just realized how just that training of meditating helps with habits, and how that that habit is so, there's a linkage, and it's just helpful to have the knowledge of that. able to renounce things.
Yeah, did people hear she was talking about how in her experience there's neuroscience shows that there's sort of a kind of a linkage as we, you know, move from the initial impulse to actually getting the thing. And so she was talking about how meditation and being aware of that impulse really is very helpful in being able to, at the very, instead of right when the thing is right there at hand, a little bit before, when the impulse just begins to be felt, it's much easier to renounce. One can say, okay, I'll wait. I won't do it right now. And I think that's really true. You know, it's sometimes we're given the instruction in meditation to be aware of that impulse to do, which is really interesting to pay attention to, because just kind of being aware of that trigger of habit and actually not following through now and then is really, really helpful. That's a good comment. Two of you. Yeah, go ahead. Sure. You're started, so go ahead. Yes.
I was just reflecting on how unaware I am of renouncing and that I do it all the time. There are some, whether it's, but it's not named by me as renouncing, but it could be in the form of, you know, not being selfish, reaching out.
Yeah, I think she was commenting, do I need to repeat or is it helpful? Yes, yeah, she was talking about being very much aware of the fact that without realizing it, we may be we are practicing renunciation very often, you know, through you know, forgetting about our own immediate needs and reaching out to somebody else through kindness, generosity, things like that, as well as also being aware over these weeks of the suffering that comes from not renouncing, from going ahead and doing the thing that maybe isn't so skillful or isn't so helpful, and just simply, and being very aware of the fact that that is suffering. And sometimes I think we really almost learn more from those experiences than when we're doing what we think we should be doing. Yeah, pain is a good teacher, unfortunately. We don't want to have painful experiences, but I think sometimes those are the ones where we really learn a lot. And if we don't learn a lot from the less painful experiences, sooner or later we'll probably have a very painful experience and we will learn and we won't have a choice. Oh yeah, that other question? Or comment.
Mm-hmm. So I really appreciated the way you described it as like renouncing the craving part of it rather than the object. Like I could not take the object, but if I still have intense craving about it, I'm still in bondage.
Yeah.
And I was thinking some of my most painful cravings are ideas that other people have to do things a particular way in order for me to be happy. And there's like such a freedom Thank you.
Yeah, she was talking about how she had, one thing was, I love the way you said this, was that it's more about the craving than the object, because even if we don't reach for the object, if we're caught up in the craving for the object, we're still in bondage to it. That was wonderful. I really love that. And it's really true. So the real freedom comes when we realize that we don't have to have it to be happy. Then she was also mentioning about how the craving can just come in layers and layers and layers. You know, if you're craving one thing and you can't have it, then you may substitute another thing. You know, if there's something you're wanting from a relationship and you're not getting it, maybe to make up for that, craving, you know, food or some sort of entertainment, and so on and so on and so on. So, and I think that's really true. You know, if we don't get one thing, we can always substitute this instead, or that instead, or that instead, or that instead, and it can go on endlessly in that way too. So that's a very helpful thing to notice. And as you were talking about, you know, that the freedom that comes when we finally are just not caught up and we realize that we don't have to have any of these things to be happy. Our happiness doesn't depend on having these various things. Anybody else?
Similarly, I've been kind of really trying to work through how to change in certain relationships and how certain relationships are so challenging over and over and over again. They always still always seem to come to the same loggerheads, and they'll think, yeah, I'll try to shift some blocks around and something else to try to make a different outcome. Family dynamics, whatever else, and they're just always perplexing, coming to the same place. But it strikes me that there's a lot of renunciation plays a big part of this. If I just kind of can see it differently, I mean, renunciating, seeing somebody always in the same role. Oh, here comes that challenging person again. Oh, somebody anticipating. I can see so much more my own anticipation of the behavior to come, you know, and that just seeing that, like, oh, there it is again. Maybe perhaps I'm bringing it on instead of being so not to blame, you know. Pass somebody the role all the time, and we're always going back and forth here because there is something that I'm contributing to that block.
Yeah.
And it's like truly shift almost requires, I mean, it's the stuff that really is so much self.
Yeah, it is.
The only way out of it is to really be able to see that shift somehow.
Yeah, she was talking about relationships and difficult relationships and how renunciation plays a big role in that too, because we can have a certain idea that this person is going to be difficult, and a preconceived idea of what their behavior is going to be like, and perhaps even though we don't intend it, almost even encourage the behavior by our assumptions. And so part of the renunciation is to be able to let go of our ideas that this is how this person is, which is very true, you know, and developing maybe some sense of equanimity that not needing it to be a certain way.
And it might be unpleasant.
It might be unpleasant,
but
yeah.
But it doesn't disturb my equanimity.
Yeah.
It's just unpleasant I can deal with. I'm not so invested in something being a particular way.
Yeah, which is a huge part of this whole process, not so much giving up everything, but giving up the idea that I have to have this, it has to be this way, I can't be happy unless I have this. So I can, you know, it is very much related. Being able to practice renunciation is very much related to the development of equanimity. So they all, it seems like they all kind of, you know, all of these feed on each other and relate to each other in very nice ways. Uh-huh.
Because
your heart leapt. That's a really great comment. You put that beautifully. She was talking about how she experienced renunciation as a kind of waking up from the dream of habit, really, from being controlled by habit and being able to, you know, to actually see clearly, more clearly, that role of habit, that the role of habit played, you know, plays in all of our lives, and how often we simply are just controlled by that force. And so renunciation, when we actually look at that and maybe pull back from that, is a kind of a waking up from the dream and the of our habit patterns. I think probably this is a good time to stop, because we don't have too much time, and I believe there are some announcements too.